This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 31st of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 195, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be lurking in the graveyard with author Peter Stanford, who'll be discussing society's changing attitudes towards the dead.
I'm dead excited about that one, Andrew. We'll also be meeting Lebanese filmmaker Sabina El Chama and Elhan Shak Arefer, programmer of a festival celebrating female filmmakers from the Arab world.
And we'll be looking at the rise of big data, the masses of online information helping companies predict where you might be tomorrow. Internet governance specialist Victor Meyer-Schoenberger will be here to make sense of it all.
That's all coming up, plus Tom Edwards will be here with next week's news, and we'll be playing some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We've done 195 of these, Andrew. We're fast approaching some sort of anniversary.
I think we should start preparing. We need a cake.
Preparing.
We need a penguin for the preparing.
Let's get a cake made just of penguins, like your mum would do, a fort.
Yes.
Or something like that.
I don't know if that joke goes around the world, but we used to have an advert in the UK that was about for penguin biscuits, and it was pick up a penguin.
Presumably that's because penguins are cold, and if they did try to speak, they would sound like that. They would have kind of a chattering beak, right?
They'd have a bit of kind of an Arctic stammer.
It's been quite a busy week. I think we've reached that point where we realised, we've made quite a lot of work for ourselves. Now we've got to finish it. Or what do you think? What do we think? We don't want that to preside over the vibe of the show.
No, we don't.
I'm going to be taking my laptop away for Easter, put it that way.
And I've been a bit grumpy this week.
Yeah, it's all right.
Anyway, we'll move from on that.
As I say, we can't let that vibe infiltrate this
grumpiness.
Radio show.
The grumpy bear is look. That's Grumpy Bear walking off into the sunset. He's gone.
Gone into the sunset.
Yeah, he's not coming back.
What do grumpy bears do in the woods?
I don't know. I think they hang out with each other. They're probably hanging with each other, but don't talk. They just kind of moodily look at each other.
They moodily lump around. Yeah, it's been a busy week, but it's kind of been okay. It'll be all right, won't it? Come Sunday, we're here and we've survived.
I'm gonna have fun. We've got eggs.
We've got. Would you
love that? What's that song that you love with all about eggs? How'd you like your eggs in the morning?
How'd you like your eggs in the morning? Yeah, Dean Martin.
Yeah.
How'd you like your eggs in the morning? I like mine with a kiss. Well, I held your gaze for quite long while I said that, didn't I?
Yes, well, you're not getting one off me. You might get an egg. That's about as far as it goes.
Well, okay, where do you keep yours?
My eggs?
To stop them melting.
I'm getting a bit of a hot flush now. Where do I keep my eggs to stop them melting? I did have an egg this week.
Keep them on the windowsill in the kitchen.
Jackie, who works in production.
Yeah.
The kind of people who supply, oddly, the rubber bands to keep our surveys in the magazine, they sent her a selection of eggs.
God, that's good, isn't it?
And she gave me a chunky egg.
That's nice. I had a bit
I've
of
literally
egg.
Had Jackie's chunky eggs. Anyway, moving on.
I don't know whether
we've had the grumpy bear. We've had the chunky eggs.
I know exactly. I don't know whether we can fit a man with a trombone as a sort of and a drum kit into the studio to react in a kind of comical musical way to your jokes, Andrew. Maybe we can get one in for episode 100 in 5 shows time.
Jokes,
200.
Even I admit it. Jokes is kind of pushing it.
What we've got coming up next is Tom
talking
Edwards.
Of jokes.
Talking of jokes, we've got the news coming up next. But jokes aside, with the one and only Tom Edwards.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Tom Edwards, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. How are you doing? How's your week been?
Hi, Rob. It's been pretty busy. We've got some changes happening on the radio
tomorrow,
the week ahead. It'll be very exciting. Urge all our listeners to, you know, to tune in.
A reboot, a revamp, a refresh.
A little bit of a reboot.
Why don't you just give us a few highlights? Because actually, we should start telling people about what we're going to be doing.
That's true. Well, from tomorrow, we'll have Midori House. Will be at 8 a.m. London time. It'll be a bit of an agenda setter in there, shaping the day ahead with some editorial voices. Always good to hear. That's why people are tuning in. We've also got a special new additional globalist programme, Globalist Asia, That's in the evening, and that's going to. Well, there's so much exciting content. I think so that's just in
the
morning. So
that's for the morning in the morning in Asia. That's right.
Yeah. And that'll be at 20:00 hours London time. So those are just two of the highlights, but plenty more besides. Some of the old favourites still there. The trusty briefing at noon London time, but people should tune in. Lots of exciting stuff. Lots of exciting sounds. It's going to be another big week for Monocle 24.
And there's something also happening around the corner for the first time. A bit of a test run. On the quiet, they're beginning to slowly... Perhaps we shouldn't retell people. Yeah, let's tell them. They're slowly opening up the cafe from tomorrow.
Oh, are they?
They're just doing... They're kind of what do you call it? Lifting the kimono. They're just kind of... They're doing that tomorrow.
Right.
Just to let you have the odd coffee.
Right.
Then they're going to shut there for a couple of days, and then they're fully open like in a week's time.
Okay. What do you call it? Dry run. A soft launch. Soft launch.
New sounds, new tastes. It's all happening. In Midori House and in Marylebone.
Only magazines that has a barista on the masthead.
I love that.
And a cake maker.
Absolutely. I'm proud of that.
Is that you as well? Is that you on Sundays?
Well, I won't be doing all the cake making, but, I like to pitch in.
Yeah. What's in your news crystal ball, Tom?
Well, talking of new eras in media, from tomorrow, not just a big day at Midori House, a big day in Burma. Private daily newspapers will begin printing in Burma. Now, obviously... A lot of criticism about human rights record. We've seen a number of reforms in Burma. But this will be the first time since the 60s that private newspapers can be published in the country. So it's a real big step in terms of bringing back free speech, giving people access to media and trying to free up the media. The media is so often the driver and as much a driver as a benefitor from new freedom that comes from the government. So it'll be a really important day.
And are there sort of major players jumping into that market, or is it going to be quite small fry, and how does that work?
I think it's going to start and be fairly gentle, fairly local, trying to give people information that they need, try and gradually open up. But I think it's going to be a really thriving market. It'll be really interesting.
How fascinating to see something kind of come from scratch again as well, and see what voices spring up.
Well, after half a century,
Well,
can you imagine if you were without any kind of independent media for that long? It would change the whole way you look at culture and the world and everything. So it'd be really interesting to see how the market takes off. And something else that's related to that, of course, being April Fool's Day, looking in your media around the world, watch out for hoaxes.
Is April Fool's an international thing?
Oh, yes.
Now I see, I don't know if you're telling the truth. You might just be warming up to trick me.
Who's the April Fool, Andrew?
Probably me, because I'll be here.
I think it's pretty much definitely me. But yeah, one to watch out. It may be only in certain Western media. If not, have a quick get on the internet and check out April Fool's if that means nothing to you.
Okay.
Excellent.
Let's move on. A slightly more serious story. So on Tuesday, the French upper house is expected to confirm its gay marriage bill on Tuesday. We've been looking at this a lot the last week on Monocle 24. It's been really interesting. Both we've had in the United States, this very... divisive legislation. We've also had legislation in this country, in France as well. There's been a huge number of protests, lots of demonstrations for and against taking place. But it should be ratified in the upper house on Tuesday. And I just think it'll be interesting to see whether the dissent is kind of contained in France. Because obviously we like to think, the Western countries are Western liberal democracies, slightly more enlightened. And you'd like to think that the passage of this kind of bill through the House could go almost unremarked. But it seems there's still quite a lot of dissent there. And it'll be interesting.
It's strange because years ago you would have imagined the French to kind of be really unbothered about people's private lives and kind of much more relaxed about these things. But oddly, the passing of the bill, yes, it had some huffing and puffing in the post, but certainly didn't bring people out onto the streets. But in France, it's kind of really antagonised that kind of religious part of that nation.
Well, and interestingly, France, of course, is a constitutionally secular country.
It's a secular country, yeah.
And yet, the Roman Catholic Church was very active in financing, I think I need to possibly say allegedly, financing and organising a lot of the anti-demonstrations. So it's a really interesting dynamic that in a secular country, you have that kind of divide about an issue like that. In much the same way as the row about whether women can cover their faces. Again, in secular society, but so much more fury from both sides over an issue like that. So really interesting.
I think it's one of those interesting things. The church feels it needs to take care of the issues that are close to its heart if it's not written into the constitution, or if there is no constitution at all, like in the UK.
I think they fear that they're going to become increasingly marginalised.
Yeah.
And so they try to make a stand, which is often kind of counterintuitive.
Will you, Rob, making a go of it?
Well, we can give it a go.
We're moving to France, me and Tom. Also, talking of dynamic duos, you two have switched places in the studio this week, which is really...
I feel deeply confused about it.
Do the next news item as Andrew did it. Let's swap personas.
Is that going to work?
No, he's going to...
Now I'm even more confused.
No, you can't just... camp up your voice, for example. That's, I know what you're going to do.
As if I would. I would not possibly.
What I'm saying, Tom, is on the radio, do an impression of your boss.
Yeah. Maybe I'll leave that. I know it's April Fool's Day, but I wouldn't want to try and work out whether the P45 that I had on my desk tomorrow is real or fake.
Because
can I give you a couple more?
Mr. Oh, it's made of sugar.
Mr. Grumpy Bear could come back out the woods.
I can't hear his footsteps. Oh my God, he's coming. Yeah. Shall I quickly move on? I've got a couple more quick news stories for you. Yeah. This is a bit of fun. Well, it depends fun. It depends how you look at it. A couple of things are happening on Friday. The Marathon des Sables is beginning on Friday. Are you familiar with this?
Is this the one through the desert?
That's right. It translates loosely as Marathon of the Sands.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that, you know, before I joined Monocle, I used to do stuff like this pretty much all the time. 6 days, 250 kilometres.
My friend's done this.
How do you feel about that? The longest day, 91 kilometres in a day.
I couldn't drive that far.
It's pretty incredible stuff. Straight through, so it's southern Morocco, through the Sahara, the toughest foot race on earth. Two people have perished in the 20 years since the race began. More than 20 years, about 25 years now. Mm. The winner last year, 20 hours only. Isn't that incredible?
20 hours what, for the 90?
No, for the entire race.
The entire race.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's genuinely staggering. I just find it absolutely remarkable. And you have to obviously cover your... you know, head from the intense sun. There's the risk of being, you know, literally burned and getting burnout, dehydration.
That's absolutely crazy.
You camp through a desert.
It's amazing.
What is there
something in the sort of the loneliness of the long distance runner is an often used phrase. I wonder whether it's harder or easier when the landscape is sort of monotonously sandy and duny and crazy like that.
I just think it must be. You think back to, you know, I think of scenes from Lawrence of Arabia and, you know, Oasis Mirage appearing and. How these people do it is absolutely astonishing. And I said 20 hours, that means you're running pretty competitive marathon times for what would be a regular marathon on the streets of a, on the agreeable seats of a European city, for example.
That's amazing.
Incredible stuff. So that's on Friday. And we'll keep an eye on it. Maybe see who wins. And
I think we should definitely do that. We need some sort of skewed angle on sport.
Absolutely. We should enter you next year. That'd be good.
Andrew, I would enter. It's quite pricey, so feel free. I think it's about $3,000.
Is it? Those people want to, I'll give it a go, don't they?
I'll chip in.
The grumpy bear will chip in. I'm into that. I'll give that a go next year. Let's talk about it.
Tom, thank you as ever for the news look ahead. Now, depending upon your viewpoint, life after death might sadly not be available to us all when we cross the threshold. But how society deals with its dead is actually a constantly evolving ritual. From ancient Neolithic burial mounds to modern-day internet memorial sites, the way we say that important last goodbye reflects the times we live in.
Our first guest today is writer, broadcaster and biographer Peter Stanford. His new book, How to Read a Graveyard, collects the history of mankind's attitudes to death to shed light on a topic often shrouded in darker hues. Peter, thank you for coming on to the Monocle Weekly. I should point out also that what's interesting about this book, you also say it's a spiritual guide as well. You're trying to prepare us a little bit for our own fate in some ways, do you think? Because in the introduction to the book, you make it clear that you do have a bit of a moment when you're walking around a graveyard and you see them crumbling and these amazing mausoleums falling down. And you have to kind of reflect that actually the people who thought in life that they would be remembered forever, bad luck, it's not going to happen.
Well, one of the great things about walking around a graveyard is first of all, it confronts you with your own mortality. We're very much a society that doesn't really like to think about death or talk about death in the way, say, that the Victorians were rather obsessed by it. But it also teaches you all those wonderful quirks of death. So if you walk around Père Lachaise, the great cemetery in the centre of Paris, you will see that often the people who are most celebrated now by posterity, most remembered certainly in this world, have rather modest graves. Jim Morrison being the absolute example, has this rather tiny sort of little modest grey stone grave. And as you wander around, there's the most gigantic tower there. And at first I thought it was the crematorium chimney, but it turns out it was built by someone called Baron Louis de Beaujour, I think he was called, who was some sort of diplomat and historian who obviously assumed as soon as he died, everyone was going to flock there and think what a marvellous man he was. And of course, we all stand at the bottom and laugh and think he built this because he thought we'd remember him, and we don't. But we do in a funny sort of way. So there is that thing about, I mean, if anyone's thinking about their own grave memorial at the moment, getting the tone quite right. I suppose the other end of the scale, the other very good example, is Keats's grave in Rome, in this rather wonderful sort of meadow-like cemetery next to the Aurelian walls with an ancient pyramid next to it. And when he died in 1821, Keats felt that no one had celebrated him until then. So he insisted that on his grave they didn't write his name. And they simply put, here lies one whose name is written water, i.e. would disappear the minute you wrote it. And of course, he's fabulously celebrated now. We all think he's marvellous, and we all read his poems, and we make films about him, and we quote him to each other. And then the rest of the graveyard is filled with all these poor, misguided souls who thought they were going to be remembered forever. And you walk around, who's he? What? That name's mildly familiar. So, you know, we just have to get that one right for a start.
I'm a fan of Highgate Cemetery.
Right.
And Brompton, of course, yep. Stars a really nice one in London. Was there a kind of golden age for the cemetery? You mentioned the Victorians. Obviously, there was a lot of pomp and circumstances surrounding Victorian burial and stuff. There seemed to be a lot of graves, maybe, and a lot of mausoleums and intricate work done at a certain time. Is that just because it's the only thing that still stands the test of time? Or was there... We're obviously not just talking about the UK, but I know that you visit Père Lachaise and Rome as well in your book.
I think there are various step changes. And what I try to do in the book is a series of journeys, really. But they're organised chronologically. Mm. And in a way, what they're trying to illustrate are these great step changes in the way that we treated burial. And the Victorian bit of that, which you see, particularly in Britain, it was a great thing. But, you know, Père Lachaise in Paris is of that period. And in Argentina, La Recoleta, where Eva Perón is buried. And they're all very much of a type, those cemeteries. That was a great change, and the big break at the beginning of the 19th century was getting out of the hands of the church, because until that point, certainly in Western Europe or in European colonies, it had been the Christian church, particularly the Catholic church, which had completely controlled burial. So if you died and you wanted to be buried in any sort of holy, sanctified, even legally recognised ground, the vicar had to accept you. And even if you were Jewish, if you were whatever, you had to undergo, certainly again in Britain, an Anglican burial service in France or Spain or whatever, a Catholic one. And what changed at the beginning of the 19th century was Napoleon, who often isn't remembered for good things, but this is one of the very good things that he did. He sort of said, actually, the church is corrupt and it makes money out of this. It doesn't bury people with any sort of dignity. It tended to chuck them all in a great pit. And there's a health problem with that as well. Terrible public health problems, particularly in Paris, because of these common pits and these badly run cemeteries. So he opened Père Lachaise. But being French, obviously, they decided it wasn't simply going to be a sort of rather nice orderly individual graves, go away church, anyone can come here as long as they can pay. There was going to be an aesthetic to it. And the Victorians very much took up that idea here in Britain. The thing that they added that was different was they added the idea of kind of making money out of it, which I suppose is a pretty good metaphor for the 21st century as well, because the French still rather cling to this idea that the state has a role in everything and it should all be organised. And here in Britain, we're obsessed by private enterprise and privatising things. So the Victorians tried to privatise cemeteries and tried to make money out of them. And it worked for a while. They built these very grand, very beautiful cemeteries. You've talked about Highgate, Brompton. There were seven of them around London called the Magnificent Seven. I think subsequently called the Magnificent Seven, not at the time. Benefits of hindsight for the living. And they all very much accord to these same very beautiful designs, every architectural style you can possibly imagine in there. A lot of Gothic, though. But they were run as private companies. So the idea was that people would pay, and because they paid quite a lot to be buried there, because they were rather beautiful places, you would carry on making money. Now, that worked for about 20 or 30 years, and then it all went terribly wrong, because once they were full, who was going to carry on paying? So how did you maintain them? How did you keep them up? The Victorian ideal was going to be that you built these beautiful cemeteries, you fill them up with bodies, with marvellous monuments of angels and crosses and broken pillars and whatever, and that then the public would use them as a park.
It's a strange thing, isn't it?
The public, public's never really wanted to walk around cemeteries, which is where I start really in the book, because I had to walk around our local cemetery to exercise our dog because it was the nearest place. But people don't like walking around cemeteries. We've never used them as public.
But do you
parks.
Think they are now? I think that this is a well timed book.
A lot of people,
despite the fact that to go to Highgate Cemetery is £4 or something.
Yes, people, free in most.
Yeah, people kind of do. There is, and that's presumably where the book comes in as an actual guide to reading what's going on. You mentioned Gothic in terms of the design. And the architecture of these places. There don't seem to be any kind of deco or modernist graves, or maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, no, you go to Père Lachaise. There are lots of deco and modernist graves. I mean, you can see, the great thing about Père Lachaise is they've used different... They mix everybody up, so there isn't a famous people section. It's not location, 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 as you get in. In a Victorian cemetery, you had to be buried in the main aisles if you wanted to be remembered.
Yeah.
And in lots of Victorian cemeteries, the further back into the cemetery you go, the smaller the graves get, until you get to the bit at the back, which was called the Potter's Field, which is where all the poor were buried. And they just got one big cross in the middle that said that basically they're all too poor to pay for their own grave, was effectively what it was saying. I'm sure it said something slightly kinder. But in Père Lachaise, they mix them up. So you get this idea of kind of almost waves as you go around. So you go in, so the early 19th century, you get a lot of these. They look a bit like telephone boxes to a British audience anyway. These sort of square house tombs.
Doctor Who's grave.
Like Doctor Who, indeed. Absolutely. They look like the TARDIS. And then you go on a bit further and lots of kind of marble, then some rather beautiful stone. And the closer and closer you get to modern times, the more sort of marble you get, strangely shiny marble, though, I suppose because it hasn't discoloured. And then there was a whole phase in the 60s and 70s of black, and now he seems to have moved back to white again now. So there are trends in all of these things that go through. But of course, what the Victorians also did was they went back and borrowed. So again, in your Victorian cemetery, you'll see the whole history of burial. You'll see a pyramid taken from the Egyptians. You'll see a broken half column, which was a Greek idea for a life cut short. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes when you look at them, you wonder, you'll sort of see the broken half column, but it'll say underneath, you know, Joe Bloggs died aged 83. And you think, well, it's hardly cut short, really, is it? He did rather well.
Three score years and ten, and then some.
Exactly. You'll see a little Greek mausoleum. They like those. Gothic, medieval fantasy castles built on things. You can teach yourself the history of architecture.
And Peter, you're talking about a kind of very grand kind of architecture there. But when you come to today, do you kind of lament a little bit that, in fact, first of all, we don't have that many graveyards now. The pressure now is on everyone to be environmental and scatter the ashes of your loved ones. And in fact, you know, even I think you refer at the beginning of the book, you know, that when your parents died, you kind of rather fancied the idea of wearing black because, you know, there were some of these ideas of piety and things. They were wearing black kind of gave people a signal, kind of back off and leave me alone with my thoughts for a little bit. And we seem to have thrown all that, you know, now we have kind of like digital websites and you can embed a video or all these things. Do you think that actually some of the things we're being told about how we bury the dead today aren't that comfortable, really?
I think you can go over the top with mourning, and clearly Queen Victoria spending 40 years walking around in black was, you know, slightly over the top. The Victorians had these very elaborate rituals and, you know, they went completely over the top. But I do sometimes wish that we did, in a way, still have some sort of signs of mourning, because I tell in the book the story of when my own parents died. And it was that thing, I don't mean this as a criticism, but there is a very much a kind of modern sense that when someone close to you has died, after about two or three days, people ring and sort of say, you know, should we go out to dinner? Should we go to the cinema? Let's go and take your mind off it. And sometimes you just want to say, actually, I don't really want to take my mind off it, if that's all right. I'd quite like to think about it. And then you're treated as if you're kind of wallowing it in a way. And that's part of this death denial that we have. So I think some of the rituals are better. I mean, you're absolutely right that there are many fewer burials. About three quarters of people who die in Britain certainly are cremated nowadays. Now, cremation came in Western Europe towards the end of the 19th century, or came back, because originally in Roman times people would have been cremated, but we brought it back towards the end of the 19th century. But originally people would have been buried either in graves in the kind of urn or in these walls with little caskets in called columbariums. They would be in there. But we don't like burial particularly because we're a bit squeamish about it. And we sort of rather hate the rigidity of a graveyard because there's still, even in your trendiest Anglican vicar, is still going to have a few little rules about what you can do and can't do in the graveyard. So people have now moved much more towards scattering. And I do think a bit of ritual helps slightly. So now you have a whole army of professional scatterers, because lots of people thought they would do it on their own. So they would take the ashes in whatever shape urn you want now and scatter them. But unless you're rather skilled at this, you can get it wrong in the wind. And mum and dad, unfortunately, there's come back into many, your face when you do it, which isn't really what you want. And I don't mean to laugh at it, but in some ways, what can we do with death apart from laugh at it? So I think that's happened. And of course, the idea was that you did all these things in a very al fresco way, and it really didn't matter where you did. All the places people chose are now banning scatterers from them. So football pitches don't want them there because it makes the grass grow strange. All the things that are in your bones do odd things to the grass. The top of all these famous mountains are now banning scatterers because they've suddenly discovered on the top of Scotland's highest mountain there's suddenly a bunch of daffodils is growing there because it's as if people have been fertilising it endlessly day in, day out. So it distorts things. So a bit of ritual. And one of the things I end the book with, really the latest one of these step changes in terms of how we bury people, which is the kind of eco-cemetery movement, which seems to me very fitting in that people are now buried either simply in meadows, they're scattered in meadows, you can be taken, literally wrapped up in a cloth and put in the ground if that's what people want, and you rot back to nature. You sort of don't take up too much ground because the ground can once again be used in 20, 30, 40 years' time. And they take away all the great memorialisation that we did, because if a field is covered with stone graves, you can't easily plough it or grow things in it. There's a wonderful cemetery up near York where someone's built an English cottage garden all around the graves. So the dead bodies literally are pushing up the daisies there. But generally in cemeteries, you can't really use them for anything more. People don't want to use them as parks. You can't use them to grow things in. So it is a waste of space in that sense. So these modern graveyards, what they're doing is it's kind of recycling. It's back to the nature thing. So no gravestones, literally just little wooden tags, which I kind of quite like. But then you think, say I was alive in 150 years' time, which, of course, I'm not going to be, I realise that, but if I was and I wanted to wander around and read gravestones, they won't be there anymore. If we're buried in an eco-cemetery, there won't be a gravestone.
Yeah, that's the problem. We'll just be in the cloud, right? That's the problem.
Exactly. Presented a great programme on Monocle. It won't say that on the gravestone because it won't be there.
And tell me, did it make you plan your own?
Yes. And this is radio. You can't tell how youthful I am listening.
But what did you come up with? As
I came up with something completely illogical. And I suppose this is the other thing about death. We are completely illogical about it. We spend some of our time up in Norfolk on the east coast of Britain by the sea. And there's a very beautiful graveyard by the sea there on a little ridge looking over sand dunes and marshes and sea. And I thought, I'd love to be buried here because it's got a great view. But of course, when I'm dead, well, what won't I be seeing? The view.
Also, I wondered whether you have that sense that maybe graveyards are going out of fashion because they have a lot of up, you know, obviously it costs a lot to keep them going, even ones you have to pay to go and see and all the rest of it. There's something kind of sadder about a kind of decrepit graveyard than there is about a death.
Do you think that's sad?
I think it's rather beautiful, but it is quite sad. There is a sadness about it for the people that it does give you an amazing perspective on the idea of not being there anymore when you can only see the top of a gravestone that's fallen over and it's covered in ivy. And it's a very beautiful, to use the word wrongly, gothic image, actually, isn't it? But there is a sadness in that.
But there's a truth in it as well, that we will all be forgotten. I mean, well, there are very few people who are remembered.
Stop looking so pointedly at me when you say
sorry, Andrew, we will all be forgotten. You're looking at me too. We will all be forgotten in that sense. And it's important to realise, I do think that one of the things we get more towards in 21st century society is the kind of, the cult of the individual makes it sound like it's a terrible thing, but with the decline of religion, the decline of collective ideas, that we all end up by believing that this magnificent creation that is ourselves, that we've all laboured so hard to make wonderful and perfect, simply is going to be remembered forever, and we're not. And I actually find that, I mean, here we are. We're sitting here talking about graves and we're laughing. We're not finding it all terribly bleak. And if only we could all get beyond that, acknowledge that death's going to happen, perhaps we could have a better conversation about these things.
This is fascinating stuff. We've got to leave it there, unfortunately. The book is How to Read a Graveyard, Journeys in the Company of the Dead. Now, that's quite a...
Indeed.
Someone's
just reviewed it and complained that I don't climb down into a grave and talk to the dead, but I think that would have been a bit ghoulish, really, wouldn't it?
Peter Stanford, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about female filmmakers in a minute, but first some music. This is new from Charlene Spiteri & Co. It's Texas with The Conversation. Time to have a conversation. It's never what you want to hear. It's funny how much words can hurt you, even after all these years. I want to make an observation. Every time I try to tell you, you blame it on your fickle heart. How they're hurting you, what are they deserting you? It's always so unfair to you. It's time to have a conversation. Give it up, I'm never gonna hold you up. You've always been afraid of love. It's time to have a conversation. Is never easy, so why don't you come over here? Tell me about the dreams that haunt you. Tell me about your secret fears. I want to change your whole perception. If only I could make you see how it's all your own creation that's bringing you this misery. How they're hurting you, more than they're deserting you. It's so, so unfair to you. It's time to have a conversation. Hold you up. You've always been afraid of love. It's time to have a conversation. The words you hear in your head will never say, will never say. The heart you break, you mistake. How they're hurting you. That was The Conversation, new from Texas. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, Turning the Tide, on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, when we talk about making films, we're often referring to the action and glamour going on in front of the camera. But our next guests today are here to talk about the talent behind it, specifically female filmmakers.
Organisers of this coming week's Bird's Eye View Film Festival in London say that women make up less than 10% of film directors and less than 15% of screenwriters. It's a shockingly unbalanced figure, but through highlighting some of the best female filmmakers from around the world this week, the festival's programmer Elom Shak Arafir and award-winning Lebanese filmmaker Sabine El Chama are working to put it right. They join us now in the studio. Elom and Sabine, thank you very much for joining us. Elom, I'd like to come first to the Bird's Eye View Film Festival. It's been going for a while. I remember doing a TV show 8 years ago and talking about it. It's got a decent history. How did you choose this year's theme of Middle Eastern and Arab female filmmakers?
Bird's Eye View has been going since 2005. This is the first time that we've got a kind of regional focus like this. It came about really because the former creative director, Rachel Millwood, was at different festivals around the world in 2010, 2011, and really felt that there was something quite exciting happening in the Arab world. And we decided to do something that we'd never done before and to have a regional focus this year. And I think we were absolutely right to do so because the programme is fantastic.
There's been a lot of good press recently about films in the Arab language that have come out, lots of great reviews, and presumably doing that important thing of making the commercial breakthrough as well, and getting well reviewed and getting notices everywhere.
Well, yeah, I think all of the major festivals in the world have had films by Arab filmmakers, and particularly female Arab filmmakers, particularly in the past year. So it's great to see the level of this kind of diversity of genres as well that are being represented everywhere, pretty much, from this side of the world.
And Sabine, tell us, why do you think there is this kind of boom in film, especially among women filmmakers in the Arab world? Is it because of the political changes we're seeing in the region, or is it just a kind of coming of age?
I want to dispel the myth that Arab female filmmakers is a novelty, because there are many women who make films, and maybe the percentage that you mentioned in the beginning, I don't know if it's where exactly in the world, but definitely if you were to only take, let's say, Lebanon, you'd see that there were many women who make films. And also the festival actually shows how active the women are. So first of all, I would say that Arab films coming from the region, including men and women, the reason I think, and if I take myself as an example for projects that sat on my shelf as scripts for ages, is the emergence of Arab support through Dubai, for example, through Doha and others. So that, in some sense, gives a lot of incentive also for co-producers from Europe to join in the adventure, you know, of financing films.
Of the films which are being shown this year, is there one or two that kind of particularly stand out for you?
Well, films that stand out, I think what I'm really pleased with the programme in terms of films that will challenge your perceptions, you know, films that you might expect to be coming out of the region. You know, within the features, I think we've got really exciting lineup of features. There are five very, very different feature films, whether it's in the form or in the style or in the voice message. I think there's a film called On the Edge, which, you know, is so gripping and different to anything you've ever seen. You know, the voices of the characters stayed in my head for weeks after having seen the film, and that's, you know, so unexpected. That, for me, is one of the strongest films that I've seen for a long time. I was very excited when I saw it and was really excited to be able to give it, you know, its UK premiere in a sense, despite first premiering over 2 years ago.
Sabine, I wanted to ask you about your film, which is sort of an inversion of quite a very of an everyday. It's called A Tuesday. And I wanted to ask you about this thing, and maybe you both can answer this. We always feel, maybe stupidly, that films from the region have to be full of hard-hitting truths, when actually there's lots of senses of humour that needs to come out, and there's lots of stories of everyday stuff that need to come out. How much do you have to battle against that thing of kind of everyone expecting a film from a region that clearly has a lot of troubles always being worthy and hard-hitting and about telling a larger truth, when it might just want to be quite a good sitcom?
Yeah, of course, there's that problem, the problem of thinking that, oh, a Lebanese filmmaker should be a representative of Lebanon, and so on and so forth. And that is a big load, because basically what happens is, because there aren't that many films getting made, not as many stories as want to be told, what happens is the films that are made then are taken as representative of the society, but they're just representative of the director's vision and the director's angle on a certain portion, you know, of life, even if they're political. And so, you know, the more films are made, the better, because then at least that pressure would be off of the backs of a lot of filmmakers, and then they can, you know, not be told, well, what did you mean by that? Did you mean that, you know, this character represents Beirut in its, I don't know what,
Heaviosity ensues. And I wanted, as the programmer, do you feel that you have to be quite balanced? You know that these films are possibly going to be seen as representative of the voice of the region, and have to kind of balance that quite artfully.
Yeah, I mean, I think we maybe have this kind of double stereotype this year, with the festival celebrating female filmmakers and this year celebrating Arab female filmmakers. A lot of people might come with this impression that they know exactly what that's going to look like. And I think the programme reflects there is no type of female filmmaking, there's no type of Arab film, there are lots of different kinds of voices. And that's really how we've chosen to balance the programme. The programme is the best filmmaking from the region and not representative of any specific country or way of doing things or showing things. And very much like Sabine's film, you know, it is, in a sense, it could be anywhere. I think what's beautiful, it's just an encounter between two people. You know, it could be anywhere, it could be anyone. And it's, you know, those things that just happen in your life maybe one day, and they're so unexpected and they take you somewhere that you didn't expect to go. And I think a good film is very much that as well. You know, it takes you on a journey you didn't necessarily expect to go on. That's what I hope everyone who comes to the festival will feel about the films as well.
You need to have a really, really mental opening night party, don't you, as well, to get rid of that aspiration, or that thought that everyone's it's going to be worthy. That's what you need to do.
We're going to have a great opening night party, of course.
All right, we're going to be there. Cool. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And tell us about the festival. Where is it on at, and how can people find out about it?
So the festival's on from the 3rd to the 10th of April. It's running at the BFI and the Barbican, the two main screens, but we also have screenings at the ICA and the Hackney Picture House. All the information's on our website.
Elum and Sabine, thank you for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about big data after this.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Big data is the name given to the seemingly almost endless depth of information on the internet about how people use, well, the internet. When you click like on a friend's post on a certain social network, or click around Amazon for that essential Kenny G classic album, your dubious taste in saxophone solos is being compiled into a huge database by marketing companies. It helps them figure out what kind of products and services to sell you. Big data means big money.
The benefits to businesses are well known, but is giving all that information away a good thing for the customer? Victor Meyer-Schoenberger is a professor of internet governance and regulation at Oxford University, and his new book, Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work and Think, has some surprising answers. He spoke to Monocle's Tom Edwards a little earlier.
We're in a world where we're surrounded by data, more and more different streams, and a lot more analysis about them, where they come from, who's in control of them. was it just to try and pick apart all of those complexities? Was that why you set out to write this particular book?
We had, I think, two missions. One was to make sense of the big data hype. There is really hype emanating from Silicon Valley and then going throughout the world right now about the data deluge and the importance of data in an age where collecting data is easy and relatively costless and all the gains and the benefits from it. And consultancies all around the world sell their services right now, sort of predicting that big data is going to be the next big thing. We wanted to go beyond the hype to really look at what at its core characterizes what big data is and why it is different from the internet age or from the e-commerce age or from the digital age before. So that was one mission of the book. And our core message there is that if you have substantially more data than ever before about the phenomenon that you want to study, the problem that you want to solve, the question that you want to answer, then you gain new insights that you wouldn't have with small data, with limited amounts of data. But the problem is that for all of human history, we have had very little data about the world. And so we understood the world through little data and lots of theory. In the big data age, that changes. And so we need to adjust. And the second big aim of the book was to just see not just what are the benefits, but how diverse are the benefits, what areas, what sectors are being changed, are being reshaped by big data, and what are the dark sides of it? What do we need to do in order to make sure that big data doesn't control us?
Now, that's interesting. You use that phrase, the dark side, that features in the book. Do you think people are right to be skeptical or cynical, perhaps, about data, their own data? We always hear this issue about the personal control of data. Do you think there's a paradox for individuals that the more we can access, the more information there is at our fingertips? In some respects, there's always more we have to give up, whether deliberately or accidentally.
Yes, indeed. And at the same time, it's so understandable that we worry about our privacy and that we worry about surveillance. But this fear also stems out of a small data world in which each data point about us we could guard, and we were very worried about if it is going to get leaked to the public. In the big data world, that continues to be a worry, but there is a new worry emerging, and that is what you actually use big data for, particularly when you use it for probabilistic predictions about future behavior, when you incarcerate people not for what they have done, but what they are predicted to do.
I mean, that's really interesting, this point about predictions. There's some interesting quotes in the book. You talk about Foucault looking at people's behaviours and the way that they act and suggesting that, you know, we know what you're going to do tomorrow. Is that the end game of all of this, absolute predictability? Or do you think that the more data there is, the more enormous that world becomes? There's always another layer of complexity to unpicking people's behaviour.
We strongly believe that there always is another layer of complexity. But that means that in many ways, predictions will get better and we will be able to predict the future in ever more detail. But at the same time, we strongly believe that we need to carve out in this new world a space for the human, a space for creativity, for irrationality, for going against what the data predicts or what the data dictates, for acting according to one's own whim, rather than according to the rational prediction that the data comes up with. And so we very strongly want to carve out the space for humanity there. And we want to ensure that big data doesn't end in a dictatorship of data.
Well, that's really interesting. I wonder how receptive do you think certain corners then of the kind of data community, if you can use such a sort of reductionist phrase, are then to that kind of notion, this idea of having the counterintuitive, of having the humanity of it. Do you think that there's a lot of interest in that, or do some of these very analytical and scientific and data-driven types, more traditional as we might consider them, are they made a bit nervous by that because it's something that you can't quantify in quite the same way?
Well, I don't think there is a need or much reason to be overly nervous. In one way, we must not forget that big data will bring a lot of benefits. And so we shouldn't not do big data just because there's a dark side out there. We should engage in big data. We should embrace it, but also be very concerned about safeguarding us against potential dark sides. And in that sense, that reminds me of Bill Joy, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, a famous internet entrepreneur and pioneer, or Ray Kurzweil, who has made the point in the singularity movement that we need to protect humanity against the silicon, against the information and against the data. So I think that our message of benefits and the need for safeguards resonates particularly well with those in the data community who are aware of both sides and who are quite aware of the need to leave a human imprint in whatever we do.
And as you worked on the book, did you find there was often any kind of disconnects between the people who sort of owned the data, this burgeoning data, and those who really understand it or who try to understand it? Is there often a gap there, for example, in if we look at businesses, for example, who are in the business of either gaining your data or controlling its distribution? Is there a disconnect there between the people who own it and understand it? And if there is that something to worry about?
Well, it's interesting. There is at times a tension, just as you describe it. And sometimes there isn't. So take Google as an example. With Google, there is no tension. They have lots of data and they perfectly understand the power of big data and the value that it provides to them. Take Google Glass, the augmented reality gadget that they are now putting forward. What is it all about in terms of data? Well, it datafies, to coin a term, our gaze. Right now, we know where people are walking, the location of people, the speed by which they're traversing three-dimensional space. But with Google Glass, what we will now know is what they're looking at. And that's incredibly powerful, especially when you're the world's largest advertising company.
That's good. But is that not frightening, though, as well? Because people will say, well, what's next? Is it what I'm thinking then next? Or what I'm feeling? Is it a kind of an endless pursuit of more and more and more?
Well, there is an endless pursuit of knowledge in the world, right? There's an endless pursuit of understanding. So in that sense, yes, it's the next step. But Google does get it. There's no question about it. Other very large companies, to answer your question, sit on huge amounts of data, but they don't know what to do with it. It's like sitting on a gold mine, but having no tools to unearth the value that you're sitting on. And they will be prime targets for these very nimble startup companies that have a big data mindset and come in and say, excuse me, can we license your data, please? Very low cost, of course. And then the unknowing large company will say, yes, sure, have the data. Do whatever you want with it and give us some extra revenues. We've seen that, for example, with the prediction of airline prices in the United States, where a startup company called Faircast was able to predict airline prices for each seat for every flight in civil aviation in the United States with a 70% accuracy, using the data licensed to it by an airline reservation system. They signed the licensing deal, the airline reservation system, not knowing that this new startup company would extract the value. There is this tension there.
There's some really good examples, actually, in the book. There's another one where Google, better than the Center for Disease Control, predicting the outbreak of flu instances. But I just wonder, is there another worry about that, which is as these techniques become more refined, as there's more of this data amassed, do, again, those people on the other side, maybe the sort of cynical observers of that, say, well, now we've seen that Google is good at this, we can affect that. We can target their means of search, their means of collating this data. Is that a problem where people sort of on the flip side can, I guess it's not quite abusing the system, but it's getting there. Is that a worry?
Yes, to an extent. Although big data tools do take that into account, at least to a certain extent. What we have here is a system whereby the people that are part of the system and getting observed also can change their behavior based on the results of the observance of the big data analysis. But take airline price predictions. They're so good, and if airline looked at that, they would say, oh my God, we need to change our algorithms by which we make airplane prices because we can be so well predicted now. The truth is that it's for them, it's very hard to change the algorithm. And even if they make small changes to the algorithm, the big data analysis of prediction of those prices catches up relatively quickly. Similarly, yes, last December, Google Flu Trends predicting the spread of the flu was off by two weeks' time by quite a bit. And the argument is that this was because many television channels talked about the flu, and so people started Googling flu information, even if though they were not sick. But Google has caught up to that, and they are now fine-tuning their algorithm. And the next time that kind of fluke comes around, they'll probably be prepared for that. The beauty of the big data system is that it is Bayesian, that it learns as we go along.
It brings me around to the point I wanted to ask you about learning then. There's a couple of instances. You mentioned that the big company sitting on their gold mine of information ripe for being abused by some nimble-footed new company. If the people who are running that big company were to read your book, what do you think the abiding message you would hope that they might take away from this book is?
The wrong message to take away would be, oh my God, we need to lock down the data that we have, and only once we are smart enough, we should use it. The real message is that, oh my God, we should look for young, nimble, entrepreneurial startup companies who can actually unearth some of the value of the data that is dormant in our data storages. And we should give it to them at a very low license rate, but with a proviso that if they make a lot of profit, we'll get a share of it. That way, we see that in deals in intellectual property. When you write a book, you're not only getting maybe some money up front, but you also get royalties. So with the royalty deals of big data, we make sure that if a young, nimble company then makes a lot of profit, the data holder gets a fair share of it.
And I guess the flip side of that is, what about for the end consumer, the individual who's maybe a little dubious about big data or certainly a little wary about it? If they were to read the book, what would you hope that they would understand afterwards?
That they themselves are probably big data users as well as data holders, and they play an important role in this game. They actually become sort of very small big data companies and can either license their own personal information in the future to various companies and gain profits if those companies profit, or get some free services out of them. In a way, big data may empower the consumers, if and to the extent that they understand that they are not just objects to be analyzed, but subjects to influence the analysis.
That was Tom Edwards talking to Victor Meyer Schoenberger. And that's all for this edition 195, Andrew, of the Monocle Weekly.
It was good.
How's your radio chat been this week?
I've done lots of good chats this week. I particularly enjoyed Peter Stafford. I thought he was very good.
I love him, yeah. He's great. Great head of hair.
I had the same, same thing when my dad died. We scattered the ashes. And then we walked back to the car and I realised there's quite a lot of them in my shoes. wasn't very good. That's the rubbish thing about kind of scattering ashes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a bit of a process because you can see the next family coming around the corner to this supposedly kind of like nice glade where you're going to be on your own.
Yeah.
They're queuing up.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a, it's a funny thing. You need to do something sort of, it's tough to find something kind of wholly original, I suppose. You just have to kind of go and do it.
Yeah, and
unless, of course, you're writing a sitcom that always happens, where the scattering of the ashes scene is always the sort of the most hilarious of all.
Someone's told me they inherited a house where the person had been left behind. Obviously, the woman had died as well, and I think that she'd left her husband. He was still on the mantelpiece, and they felt really kind of bad about what to do with him. So they just kind of left him there for like another few years.
That's quite accommodating, I'd have said, isn't it?
Yes.
We didn't know what to do with yeah, I know, it's a funny thing. Peter Stafford was great. I think it's a fascinating thing. As soon as I saw that book land on our desks, I was like, that's great. And it would make a good TV show, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
he'd be good on the telly.
Yeah, and there's some properly amazing yarns in there.
We should thank our producer, Tom Hall, our researcher, Josh Fennett, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch, and Ben Jay. I think I can see right there through the glass. I think we've had a bit of a switch up halfway through the show. We'll be here, same time, same place, next week. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.